This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Ken Ward Jr. is a reporter at West Virginia's Charleston Gazette-Mail, where since 1991, he's been covering the coal, chemical, and natural gas industries and their impact on communities. He's also a member of ProPublica's Local Reporting Network, and this year, Ken was awarded a so-called Genius Grant from the MacArthur Foundation. Ken, congratulations, and welcome to On the Media.
Thank you very much.
Let's go back 27 years ago. In most places, a young reporter gets assigned the coal beat, and the response might be, coal? Really? Got nothing in politics for me, maybe? Or, I don't know, obits? But in West Virginia, coal is, or was, king. What was it like when you first got started covering that beat?
Well, my experience with coal goes back even a couple years before I started full-time at the Gazette. I did an internship in the summer of 1989, and that was the summer that the United Mine Workers of America union was on strike against a company called Pittston Coal, and I got assigned to help cover the strike. One of the jokes in the newsroom was that because I was an intern, I wasn't on the company health plan, so if there was any trouble on the picket line, it would be okay. But I spent that summer kind of driving around with a photographer, Jim Nolker, talking to coal miners on picket lines and hearing their stories about what it was like to work underground and listening to them talk about the struggles over decades and decades between miners and mine operators. And it was just a fascinating sort of world that was new and different to me. And that was kind of it for me. I knew that that's what I wanted to do.
So you got labor disputes, you've got worker health and safety, wages, environmental stuff. What else does the fossil fuels beat look like?
It has a lot to do with politics here. The coal industry is still very powerful politically, probably more powerful politically than it is economically. And so there's a lot of fact-checking of politicians who say one thing or another about the coal industry and the cause of the coal industry's decline and those sorts of things. And, you know, unfortunately, a lot of my work over that time has been kind of death and disaster and destruction, mine explosions that kill 29 people or mine cave-ins that kill people, worrying about the safety of coal refuse dams and chemical plant explosions and those sorts of things that seem to come with the heavy industry here in West Virginia. And part of what I've tried to do with my coverage of those is to write about how those are preventable sorts of disasters. They're things that didn't have to happen and that West Virginians don't have to just kind of accept that as the lot in life in exchange for having these industries.
Not to mention the collapse of the coal economy and I guess the loss of market share in BTUs, the heyday long since passed.
Sure. And one of the things certainly over the last 10 to 12 years that I've tried to focus on is writing stories that will illuminate for local readers here in West Virginia the real factors that played into the decline of coal rather than just kind of this hysteria about government regulations and President Obama and the EPA to try to break all of that down for people in a way that they can understand so they can see that the long-term curve for coal industry jobs has always been downward and it's expected to continue that way.
You got the MacArthur Grant for, partly at least, for speaking truth to the most powerful forces in West Virginia. Now, with the understanding that you were maybe a preternaturally combative reporter at the birth of your career, how have the relationships evolved between you and Big Coal, for example, since you were a callow young cub?
It would probably surprise a lot of folks who don't know me and don't really know people in the coal industry. There are a lot of people in the coal industry that are some of my best sources. And certainly when one company does something not very good, other companies like to tell me about it. But there's also an awful lot of people that work in the coal industry that, like me, are West Virginia natives who want to see the state succeed and aren't always very happy if they feel that their neighbors are getting the short end of the stick. And there's a lot of people that have been regulators of the coal industry that have been very helpful, and I've learned a ton from about how the regulations do and don't work. And I would say that one of the things that's been the most gratifying to me is to get a sense that families of miners who get hurt and killed on the job, regardless of how they felt about the newspaper before that happened, they seem to rely on us, and it maybe gives them some small bit of comfort when we write stories that kind of illuminate the needlessness of deaths and injuries in mining so that maybe we can prevent some other death or injury from happening.
You know, there is this conventional wisdom, I guess, outside of West Virginia in journalistic circles, that Appalachian communities are these benighted people who are so dependent on the industries that are doing them so much harm, they vote against their own interests, and that they're too poorly informed or too cowed by power to really look out for themselves.
It's pretty low-hanging fruit when the national press, outlet after outlet, comes to West Virginia to do the Trump Country story. And all you really need to do is insert the name of the diner where they stop to have a cup of coffee or lunch. And it's the same story over and over again. When if they had driven a few miles further down the road, they would have found some sons and daughters of coal miners who were creating a new future for West Virginia in some other sort of industry. And I've gotten to the point probably where I'm immune to the feelings that a lot of my colleagues or my neighbors get when they see West Virginia portrayed one way or another in the national press. I would kind of flip it around a little bit. If it's true that West Virginians are dependent on an industry that causes them problems, well, why is that? Is it because people in other parts of the country like cheap electricity or inexpensive steel? Is it because our country wanted to win World War II? Wanted to have an industrial revolution? You know, Senator Manchin likes to talk about how the rest of the country really owes a lot to West Virginia and to coal miners for the sacrifices that have been made here. And it's very easy for people in other places to make those kinds of judgments. It's speaking from a bit of privilege. Don Marsh, who was editor of the Gazette when I started there, used to talk about hillbillies being this minority that it was okay to pick on. And I think, unfortunately, there's still a little bit of truth to what Don said.
On the other hand, your own governor has followed the Trump strategy of criticizing the press, especially when it is holding these big industries accountable for whatever, the environment, worker safety, you name it, and asserting that every negative story is robbing West Virginia of jobs. What effect does that have you in going about your business?
Governor Jim Justice, his criticisms of the press seem to mostly be aimed at saying we don't write enough good stories about him. He thinks that the newspaper where I work is driving jobs left and right from West Virginia, and this administration in our state government is the most inaccessible and least transparent of any in my time. Periodically, we'll get somebody who's running our Department of Environmental Protection who decides, well, you know, we're not talking to Ward. Forget that. He's not getting any information from us. And it usually lasts a couple of months. And they get tired of it. They realize it's not really going to help. We're still going to write about them. But the current administration, they continue this sort of gag order that goes across different agencies. And they're in the process now of creating kind of a new wing of state government, a communications hub, which is aimed at just getting their message out.
Ministry of Propaganda.
Yeah, it sounds a lot more like running for office than it does governing. Just as the national press has to just kind of dig in and work harder sometimes, because of the way President Trump is handling things, just shows even more the need for us to be strong and do good reporting.
Is reporting on these industries harder? Has your day-to-day job changed because big coal isn't quite the 900-pound gorilla it once was?
As coal's size and economic impact decreases, the job changes. One of the things we're really trying to dig into and deal with is legacy liabilities of these industries. There's been a great movement by many companies to use bankruptcy, the liability for retiree health care and retiree pensions. The UMWA won a victory in Congress protecting health care for retired mine workers and their families, but it's still trying to protect hard-won pensions that coal miners worked for decades to earn, and trying to address the promises that the coal industry has made for a century in West Virginia, that, you know, everything was going to be great. Why is it that after a century of coal mining, West Virginia is still so poor?
One of the effects of coal losing its market share is that natural gas, which is another West Virginia resource, is booming. And you're seeing a kind of deja vu, are you not?
I think so. I think one of the big questions for West Virginia is, what has West Virginia learned from its relationship with coal that can inform and improve our communal relationship with natural gas? What can we do as far as taxation to support schools and roads? What can we do about environmental regulation to make sure that our land and water and air are protected? What can we do to make sure that more West Virginians are the folks who get the jobs from that industry? What can we do to make sure that one day, someday, when natural gas starts to decline too, communities won't be left hurting the way they are hurting now that coal is on the decline? And I think those are real challenges for journalism, that it's our responsibility to ask those kind of tough questions and try to force the discussion of those things more out into the open than the industries involved or the political leaders would like.
The coal industry is obviously filthy. It's obviously dangerous. It obviously fouls the environment with sulfur and particulate matter and blows the tops off of mountains. And natural gas is a whole lot cleaner, but you're making two points. It's not perfect. It's not environmentally pristine. And also, by the way, let's not make the same mistake we made with coal and not fund the life after natural gas.
I think there's a lot of people who live in communities or live right next door to these giant Marcellus shale well pads, or whose communities have roads that are clogged and torn up from Marcellus shale gas trucks, who might disagree with the characterization that everything is just fine. You know, this industry is causing a lot of on-the-ground sorts of problems. And like a lot of industries, it was initially slow to try to respond to them. I think that climate scientists would say that, especially given some of the regulatory rollbacks by the Trump administration, the methane leaks and emissions all up and down the production chain of the gas industry are a serious threat to the planet's climate. I think there's lots of those kinds of concerns. In West Virginia with the natural gas industry, we actually did something. We looked like we were doing something forward-thinking. We created a future fund to take a portion of natural gas taxes and set it aside, kind of the way Alaska has the permanent fund. But in our case, rather than sending everybody a check, it was going to use it for infrastructure and education. The problem is that we never put any money in the fund. We created a future fund, but haven't funded it. So I think that, yes, one of the big mistakes that West Virginia has made is not planning ahead clearly for the day when the bottom was going to drop out of the coal industry. And we seem to be kind of waffling around about whether we're going to plan for that same day with the gas industry.
The motto of your newspaper, which I love, is sustained outrage. How do you do that? How do you sustain outrage, in your case, over 28 years? Does despair not sink in?
Oh, despair, gosh. I think sometimes you get tired. Sustained outrage was a term that Ned Chilton, the late publisher and owner of the Gazette, coined, where he thought that newspapers would write a story about some outrageous thing that was happening and then just move on to the next outrageous thing, rather than pounding after that outrage day after day until somebody did something about it. I think that that's the hallmark of really courageous local investigative reporting. Newsrooms are places where everybody loves to complain. They cut 10 inches out of that story. Why can't I cover that beat? I'd be better than that person. You know, well, I like to complain about everything. But really, I mean, we've got it pretty good. I'm not crawling underground, you know, in a couple foot thick coal seam, getting black lung, risking my life every day to put food on the table for my family. I get to just drive around West Virginia like I did the last couple of days, just talking to people and looking at things and learning new stuff.
Well, it's nice work if you can get it, Ken, but sustained outrage is one thing. Sustained profits are something else altogether. The previous owners had to turn out the lights. The newspaper economy across the country, in fact, across the world, is in precipitous decline. You have new owners. How long is your beat sustainable?
You know, I think there's always going to be a need for watchdogs in our communities, and not to kind of, you know, citizen journalism and that sort of stuff. But, you know, that's not who's going to do a year-long investigation of President Trump's taxes, or that's not who's going to be sitting at the county commission meeting or the circuit court hearing every day. And that's what we do. And how long is it financially stable? I don't know. I think readers are starting to understand that journalism isn't free, that this idea that any bit of news about their community that they want is out on the internet or on Facebook for free. I think people are starting to understand that that's not the case. And there's lots of new models for trying to finance it and make sure that we still have investigative reporters. One thing I know for sure in West Virginia is that we hear our leaders in the state talk a lot about brain drain, about our best and our brightest are leaving for other states to go find better job opportunities and those sorts of things. And there certainly is a brain drain in journalism in West Virginia. And I've seen too many co-workers and colleagues, West Virginia natives, friends of mine, who decided they couldn't make it work here. And I think that if West Virginia is going to survive, all due respect to Governor Jim Justice, if West Virginia is going to survive and thrive, we've got to find models to make journalism work here so that young people want to stay here and do this kind of work.
When they parachute in to do a story on Trump country or anything else, they regularly miss.
I will admit to occasionally becoming unreasonably frustrated with phone calls from out-of-town reporters who want me to give them the name of one coal miner they can go and talk to about how that coal miner is in favor of Donald Trump. And I said, well, why don't you just like come here and spend some time, get to know some people. And if you want to talk about the stereotyping of a place, West Virginia is actually a remarkably diverse place if you really stop and think about it. The Eastern Panhandle and Potomac Highlands, where I'm from, part of it now is kind of a DC suburb almost. There are still some glass plants here. And the Morgantown, Clarksburg, Fairmont area is a high-tech area with West Virginia University that's doing all sorts of advanced research and great stuff. The state isn't just one big coal mine.
So the Gazette has started piling up a lot of big national awards. It got the Pulitzer for its reporting on the opioid epidemic in West Virginia, and you now have the MacArthur Award, which comes with a $625,000 stipend. And I'm just curious, let's just say some fancy news organization from New York calls you and says, you know, Ken Ward Jr., we need you. Would you consider such a thing, or are you content being a really big fish in a pretty small pond?
Oh, gosh. Well, you know, I've occasionally gotten those kind of calls from people, and, you know, this is home for me. West Virginia's home. My wife is a West Virginia native, and she's a legal aid lawyer, and I think one of the things that drew us together and continues to sustain our family is our shared love for West Virginia and our shared desire to try to do things to make it better. You know, everything that I have, you know, West Virginia gave to me, and I think I have a sense of duty to try to give back. And one thing that I know for sure is that when I look at the people who have been MacArthur Fellows before me, and wow, they're just, I mean, just giants in all sorts of fields. And it's very clear that this is not supposed to be a parting gift, you know, when you're leaving the stage, an end of career sort of tip of the hat. It, you know, they want to encourage people to do more and better things. And somebody there, maybe on a bad day, thought that I had something that I could do that was special or unique or different. And I feel some duty to figure out exactly what that is and try to do it for West Virginia.
Ken, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Ken Ward is on the energy beat for the Charleston Gazette Mail and a recipient of the 2018 MacArthur Fellowship, commonly known as the Genius Prize.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.